always reading something. And more often than not, I'm reading several things at one time. And one of the things I do when I think about what I want to read, I do some recreational reading. And by recreational reading, I mean history and biography. Sometimes a little science fiction, maybe. And then I try to make sure that I'm reading things that can enhance my understanding of the scriptures or help me in my spiritual walk, to help me to be able to express the truths of God's word to other people. And so I try every year to have some things laid out, some things scheduled to read. And one of the things that I do, and I started doing this a long time ago, is every year I go back and reread some things that I've already read before. Very important, and especially, you know, considering the work, can be very helpful. It's almost always true that when you reread something that is valuable, you read it the second time or the third time, you will get insights that you missed the first time. And so this year I had a couple of things that I was reading again. I just for joy, just for fun, I've been rereading C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia. It's a real joy reading those books again. This is probably the third or fourth time. I'm not finished yet, but this will be the third or fourth time at least that I've read all the way through those books. And another of C.S. Lewis's books that I had on my list to read this year, and I don't know how many times I've read this before, you know, three or four times at least, but it's a book that Lewis wrote called The Four Loves. It is not light reading. It is not recreational reading. It's written on a very high level, an academic level. It is a book that Lewis wrote to explore the nature of love and what we know about love from the Christian perspective, especially from the Christian perspective. Lewis was very skilled in language, English literature. And he was closely associated with people who were very skilled in language. And so one of the points that Lewis would make from time to time is that English is not especially an expressive language. And the word love is one of the ways that he illustrated that. We use one word to describe lots of different things. And so we would say, for example, I love ice cream. And we would say, I love the, you know, do I dare say Kentucky Wildcats, or would Louisville Cardinals have been better, or the Hilltoppers. I love the Hilltoppers. I love Mexican food. And we use the word love that way all the time. We might say to people who are not related to us, but with whom we have a special relationship, I love you. And that means something, but it means something a little different, does it not, than saying I love ice cream? At least I hope that it does. But we're using the same word. And by the same token, when a husband says to his wife, I love you, or a wife says to her husband, I love you, doesn't that mean something even a little different? And that was Lewis's point, that in English we use one word to describe a myriad of situations. Love is just one example of that. We actually do that a lot. Whereas in many foreign languages, and especially in many ancient languages, those concepts would all fall under different headings, and different words would be used. And so he wrote this book about the English word love, and what he saw happening. He wrote this book in 1960. He died in 1963, so not long after he wrote it. But Lewis was already seeing in the late 50s, it was published in 1960, I think he wrote it in 58, but Lewis was already seeing that the word love was coming to be used in ways that were not necessarily proper or appropriate. And so he wrote this book. And what he does in this book is he's looking at four different Greek words. Four different words that the Greeks used. And we're not talking necessarily so much about modern Greek or, Greek as it's spoken in the world now, but classical Greek. Or the way that the word love would have been used in the New Testament. And you can see, and maybe you can see on the cover of this book, affection, friendship, eros, and charity. are the four words he used. What I want to do is I want us to look at those four words for a few minutes in the lesson tonight. But I want us to think about it especially in the context of the significance of each of those four words and what the differences, the nuances in meaning are, and how that impacts marriage and our marriage relationship. The marriage relationship is extremely important. The very first human institution that was devised by God was the marriage relationship. After he created Adam and then provided for him a suitable companion, they were brought together, and we read that story in the first three chapters of the book of Genesis. He brings them together into a unique relationship, the marriage relationship. Failure to understand the importance of the marriage relationship caused lots of problems in biblical history, not just in world history or ancient history, but in biblical history. What we want in our marriages is we want a marriage where we can say, I love you, and mean everything about love that God intended to be a part of marriage. So I want to look at those four Greek words. This is not an attempt or an effort on my part to impress you with my knowledge or understanding of Greek. And this really isn't, what I'm going to talk about today really isn't necessarily from Lewis's book, The Four Loves. It just kind of planted this idea in my mind reading it again a few months ago. But this is what we want for our marriage. We want to be able to say I love you and mean all of these things. And so I want to look at the four words. And the first word we want to think about is the Greek word storge. And that's how that's pronounced, storge, or at least that's my understanding of how it's pronounced. The word storge doesn't appear in that form in the New Testament, but it does appear a couple of times in the New Testament, three times in the New Testament, with the prefix a, or aleph attached to it, alpha attached to it. And when that prefix is attached to a Greek word, it negates the word. So whatever storge means, by putting the prefix A in front of it, it negates it. So in Romans chapter 1, we're studying the book of Romans in the auditorium Bible class, and in Romans chapter 1, Paul indicts the Gentile world of the first century, and one of the things he says about the Gentiles that was characteristic of the Gentiles is that they are heartless. That's what the ESV says. The New American Standard and the New King James say unloving. And that same thing happens in 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 3. In Romans chapter 12 and verse 10, Paul uses that word again, the Roman word storge, compounded with philos, and it's translated brotherly affection. The word storge is the word that the Greeks would have generally used, and please understand that the Greeks use these words sometimes interchangeably, especially three of these four words. They sometimes used interchangeably, but the words had different nuances of meaning. The word storge generally carried with it the idea of family love. That's important for us to understand. You know, we have people in this audience who have been married for decades. We have people in this audience who have only been married for maybe a matter of months or just a few years. We have some people in this audience who are just a few days away from being married. That it's important, it's so vital and important for us to understand that when we enter into that relationship with a husband with a wife or a wife with a husband, we are entering into a family relationship. We become family. As a matter of fact, I believe, and especially when you look at the story about Eve being created for Adam and Eve being brought to Adam and how that relationship grows and develops, that's clearly what God understood. That's clearly what God had in mind. Adam needed a family. He needed someone with whom he could interact in every conceivable way. And so God provided for him Eve. When we are married, we are family. We become family. As a matter of fact, I will say this, and this is a point that Lewis makes in the book, The Four Loves. Your closest, if you are married, your closest kin, that's a good Kentucky word, right? Your closest kin is your spouse. Yeah, when you get married, your closest kin is not your parents any longer. And when you become kin, when you become married, your closest kin is not your siblings any longer. Your closest living relative is your wife. And if that's true, then what does that say about the marriage relationship? And whether or not storge or family love is a part of that relationship. Well, again, the word is not commonly used in the New Testament, but the concept is very popular in both the Old and the New Testament. If I have storge love, family love, if I understand that my spouse, my husband or my wife is family, that they are my closest family, then what that means is I am going to be completely devoted to them. And we see that in Genesis chapter 2 and verse 24, do we not? It's interesting that God says this to Adam and Eve, that therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife. Adam didn't have a father and mother. And Eve didn't have a father and a mother. And yet this is such an important concept that that's the language that God uses to describe what's happening with Adam and Eve. That you are now family. You have no other relationship. You will have no other relationship. And let me add something that I meant to say just a minute ago. Your spouse is your closest kin. That's true even of your children. And one of the things that we try to tell when we talk to engaged couples, one of the things that we try to say to young married couples or couples who are just beginning to have children is, as important as that relationship is with your children, it is not more important than your relationship with your spouse. And it never will be. Your most important relationship will always be with your spouse. The closest kin that you will ever have will always be your spouse. And that's why I ask that Ecclesiastes chapter 4 be read just as the scripture reading. And let's go back and look at that again. In Ecclesiastes chapter 4, he's not talking about marriage here, but it's a good description of the marriage relationship. Where Solomon says, or the author of the book of Ecclesiastes says, two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their toil. For if they fall, one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him who is alone when he falls and has not another to lift him up. Again, if two lie together, they keep warm. By the way, that's not talking about a sexual relationship there. It's broader than that. But if two lie together, they keep warm. How can one keep warm alone? And though a man might prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him. A threefold cord is not easily broken. Devotion to my spouse, dedication to my... You become a team. You are the closest kin. You are the closest family. You become a partnership. That's storge love. That's the concept of storge love. And, you know, I saw some interesting looks on people's faces when I said, and I believe this. Your relationship with your children is secondary to your relationship with your spouse. And one of the things that causes problems in marriage very often is when one of the marriage partners decides that my relationship with my children takes precedence or priority over my relationship with my spouse. But we need to be, if we have storge love, if God blesses us with children, we are going to be good parents. We're going to be devoted to our children. We talked about Proverbs 22:6. I'm not going to go through that again in a lesson a few weeks ago. Train up a child in the way he should go, and even when he is old, he will not depart from it. 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 8, if anyone does not provide for his relatives, and especially for members of his household, he is denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. And read again the acrostic poem, the beautiful acrostic poem that's found in Proverbs chapter 31, beginning in verse 10, which identifies the characteristics of someone who is called a worthy woman, a worthy wife. That's storge love. What will a wife do for her husband? What sacrifices will she make? What will she do for her family? Storge love. I'm going to be devoted to my spouse because we are family. I'm going to be the best parent that I can possibly be. I'm going to be a good partner, a pleasant partner, a delightful partner. I want to be real careful here. I know I'm treading on some thin ice. But have you ever known a couple? Maybe you visit with a couple, you spend a little bit of time with a couple, and you go away, and what you're wondering is, how can she stand him? What did he see in her? They always disagree. They always argue. They always fuss. There's always something unpleasant going on. By the way, You know, Susan and I have known a couple, not here, so don't start thinking, don't start looking around, not even in this state. But we knew a couple one time, they bickered all the time. And when we first met them, we thought, this is terrible. This is terrible. What we learned over time was, I don't know how this works, but what we learned over time was that that's how they were expressing their, in some kind of a twisted way, that's how they were expressing their love for one another. I don't recommend that. I don't recommend that. It doesn't work. I'm going to be as pleasant a partner, as agreeable. I'm almost choking on these words. It would be easier to preach this if Susan wasn't sitting right there and looking at me. I'm going to be, let me turn over this way and talk to you all. I'm going to be the most pleasant partner that I can be. In Genesis chapter 26 and verse 8. And this is one of those glitches in the life of Abraham. But Moses says when Abraham had been, and he's living with the Philistines, when he had been there a long time, Abimelech, the king of the Philistines, or he's talking about Isaac, I'm sorry. Abimelech, the king of the Philistines, looked out of a window and saw Isaac laughing. I like this translation. Laughing with Rebekah, his wife. The Hebrew word may actually involve a little bit more laughing, a little bit more physical contact. But I think the idea is that when Abimelech saw them together, he knew they must be married. Because they enjoyed being with one another. Here's the danger. Here's the danger, young married couples who are just having children. Here's the danger of placing your children ahead of your spouse. One of these days they're going to be grown and gone. And you're going to be sitting there looking across the breakfast table at somebody you don't know. Because you've devoted so much of your time and so much of your energy and so much of your attention to your children that you've neglected your relationship with your spouse. And so as important as it is that we be dedicated to being good parents, what I'm suggesting is if storge love is a part of our marriages, we're going to understand and recognize and appreciate and work very hard to make sure that we understand family love. Brotherly affection, that we're going to understand that that's an important part of the marriage relationship. You are family. You are family. You are partners. You are a team. So that word again doesn't appear in that form in the New Testament, but the next word, the word doesn't appear in the New Testament, but the concept certainly does. It is the Greek word eros. It is the word from which we get our English word erotic. Again, the word in that form doesn't appear in the New Testament. But this is the Greek word, this is the word that the Greeks would use to describe the physical relationship, the sexual relationship. What do we call sex in our society, in our culture? And for as long as I've been aware, what do we call it? We call it making love. We use the word love to describe the sexual relationship. The Greeks had a different word for that. It was the name of the Greek god of love. The Romans called this particular Greek god Cupid. But it is extremely important to understand the role that this kind of love plays in a marriage relationship. If we recognize and appreciate the importance of eros or erotic love, sexual love in our relationships, it strengthens the bond, that family bond. It strengthens the bond between a husband and a wife. It is an exclusive love. So in Genesis chapter 24 and verse 67, when Isaac's mother Sarah had died, and he's in mourning, and a servant is sent to find a wife for him, and they bring her back. It says in verse 67, Isaac brought her into the tent of Sarah, his mother, and took Rebekah. It's a euphemism. For he consummated the relationship between them. He took her. And she became his wife, and he loved her. So Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. Comforted after his mother's death. Not just because she was there. That was important. Not just because now he had a spouse. Not just because now he had a wife. But the sexual relationship played some role in that. The sexual relationship is an important part of the relationship that Adam and Eve had from the very beginning. The euphemism that is used very often in the Old Testament to describe the sexual relationship is the word new, K-N-E-W. We see it in Genesis chapter 4 and verse 1. Adam knew Eve, his wife. Well, what does that mean? The next phrase says, she conceived and bore Cain, saying, I have gotten a man with the help of the Lord. That sexual relationship is an important part of the marriage relationship. I feel like I need to say there might be circumstances, and as a matter of fact, I think Paul touches on this in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, that there might be circumstances in which the sexual relationship is absent from a marriage relationship. But what I would suggest to you is that that's the exception, that's not the rule. God intended for Eros to be a part of the marriage relationship. And as a matter of fact, he intended for Eros to be a significant and important part of the relationship. How do we seal that bond, that family bond, that relationship that we have? Well, one of the ways is through Eros. Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 4, let marriage be held in honor among all, and let the marriage bed be undefiled. Why is he talking about the marriage bed? What does he mean? Again, euphemistically, what does he mean when he talks about the marriage bed? He goes on to say, for God will judge the sexually immoral and the adulterous. Marriage bed, he's talking about the sexual relationship. And what he says about it is that when it is participated in between a man who has the right to be married and a woman who has the right to be married, and they are married to each other, it is pure. It is right. And it was intended by God to be that way. And it is exclusive. The only partner, the only sexual partner that a man in his lifetime can have is his lawfully wedded wife. The only sexual partner that a woman can have in her whole lifetime is her lawfully wedded husband. It is an expressive love. It is one of the ways that we show our spouse that we are totally committed to them, that we are completely dedicated to them, that they are the closest person in the world to us. Isn't it significant that the only relationship in which Eros is allowed is the relationship between the husband and the wife? Doesn't that tell us that God intended for us to understand that that relationship is the most important of all the relationships that we have in the world? There is no other relationship more important than that. So Paul, I mentioned 1 Corinthians 7 a moment ago. Paul says, beginning in verse 3, the husband should give to his wife, this is the ESV rendering, her conjugal rights. And again, I think that's a good translation. I think that is precisely what Paul is talking about. And likewise, the wife to her husband. For the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do you notice the sexual equality there, by the way? The sexual equality, it's not a man's domain. It's not primarily a male thing. It is something that they both share. The wife doesn't have authority over her own body, but Paul says, likewise, the husband doesn't have authority over his body either. So do not deprive one another. Do not deprive one another. What Paul is saying by inspiration there is sex is an important part of the marriage relationship. And if you're going to deprive one another, do it by agreement for a limited time, that you may devote yourself to prayer. Then come together again. Come together how? Come together sexually again, so that Satan may not tempt you. The sexual relationship is an extremely important part of marriage. Maybe we don't do enough teaching about that. It's hard to talk about publicly. It's hard to talk about in a mixed audience. It's hard to talk about in an audience that has children in it. I understand that. I recognize that. But the scripture is very clear that Eros, this is an important part of the marriage relationship. We were created as sexual beings. What was the purpose of that? What did God intend for that? For one thing, he intended procreation. He intended for us to bear children, to populate the earth. That's that, at least at the very beginning. But passages like 1 Corinthians, or Hebrews chapter 13, 1 Corinthians chapter 7, clearly indicate that he had another purpose as well. It bonds the husband and the wife together in a way, in a bond that they will not experience with any other living human being. They never experienced a bond like this with their parents. They will never experience a bond like this with their children. They will not allow themselves ever to experience a bond like this with anyone except their spouse. It is an expressive love. It is the way, men, that you say to your wife, I love you above all others. Ladies, it is the way that you say to your husband, I love you above all others. I'm giving myself to you totally. It is an emotional love too. In Ephesians chapter 5, the Apostle Paul talks about the marriage relationship. He tells us that the reason he's doing that is because he's talking about the church. He's using marriage to illustrate the church. But he says in verse 22, wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. And then in verse 25, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. Sex in marriage is an expression of emotion. It is an expression of love. Eros is an important part of the marriage relationship. And parents, I mean, let's be candid. I hope without being offensive, we need to be teaching this to our children. We need to be teaching our children not just about sex. I think that's the problem. We need to be teaching our children what sex is. Sex is designed to bond a man and a woman together in their relationship as husband and wife. Sex is what eros is, what brings them closer together and bonds them together. It is exclusive. It is expressive. It is emotional. The third word is a word that I think probably, like eros, I think most of us would have heard of eros. All of us will have heard the word phileo. And we understand and recognize that this is a word that appears in the New Testament, at least in that form some 25 times in the New Testament. Phileo is the Greek word that signifies friendly affection. It is friendship love. Friendship love. So we've talked about family love, storge. You and your spouse are family. As a matter of fact, you are the closest kin that you have. Leave father and mother and be joined together to your wife. When you become married, when you say I do, your closest living relative is your spouse. And there's eros love. The sexual relationship is an important part of marriage. It bonds the couple together in a way that they will not be bound with any other living human being. And phileo is important. It's sad, I think, that some people might even understand the family part of it. And almost everybody understands the eros part of it. But we don't always grasp the significance of the friendship part of it. Your spouse should be your best friend. Your spouse should be your best friend. You know what I hear sometimes? A little editorial comment. You know what I hear sometimes? Susan always cringes when I editorialize. But sometimes I'll hear people say, you know, I can't date him. We're good friends. I can't date her. We're good friends. Let me tell you something. What better foundation to build a marriage on than friendship? It's an important part of marriage. Your spouse should be your best friend. And let me tell you something. If your spouse is not your best friend, your marriage is in trouble. But whether you recognize it or not, if you'd rather spend time with the guys than with your wife, your marriage is in trouble. If you'd rather spend time at work than with your husband or with your wife, your marriage is in trouble. If you'd rather spend time with your children than with your spouse, your marriage is in trouble. God intended for us to understand and recognize friendship is an important part of marriage. Companionship. I like you. I like you. As a matter of fact, I like you a lot. I'll take it a step further. I like you more than I like anybody else. I would rather be with you. I will go into antique stores if I'm with you. I will go on cruises with you. I just want to be with you. That's phileo, companionship. It's the love of best friends. There is a passage in 1 Samuel chapter 18 that in our modern culture is twisted and perverted. And it's not talking about marriage. It's talking about the relationship of two men. But it says in 1 Samuel chapter 18 and verse 1, as soon as he had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. Again, that's just talking about the love of companions. But that's what God intends for the marriage relationship, that we be knit to our spouse. That we love our spouse as our own soul. John 16:27, near the end of his life, Jesus said, "For the Father himself loves you because you have loved me and have believed that I came from God." God loves you because you loved me. It is the love of friends. It is the love of best friends. We love to spend time together. We have fun together. We share activities together. We share interests. Let me tell you something. Those of you who are heading toward marriage, those of you who are newly married, haven't been married for a long time, what you've heard is absolutely true. If you're working hard to make your marriage the kind of marriage that God would have it to be, you will become, ladies, I apologize in advance for saying this, you will become more and more like your spouse. You will find that you like the same things. You will like things that you never liked before. Why? Because she likes them. He likes them. You will like doing things that you never liked to do before. Why? Because that's what he likes to do. Because that's what she likes to do. You will enjoy doing almost anything as long as you can do it together. You will confide in one another. If you've got problems, you're not talking to your parents. You've left father and mother. You're not talking to your girlfriends. You're not talking to the guys you hang around with. You're talking to him. You're talking to her. You are confiding in each other. The very first place, if you need something, if you need help, if you need encouragement, the very first place you go is you go to your spouse. You count on them. You count on each other's loyalty. You are best friends. And let me tell you something. There is not a better feeling in the world than being in love with your best friend. There's not a better feeling in the world than being loved by your best friend. Communication. In Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 29, and I know I've already kind of talked about communication a little bit, but I'm going to turn it around and talk about things we shouldn't say maybe. But in Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 29, Paul said, "Let no corrupting talk come out of your mouths, but only such as is good for building up, as fits the occasion, that it may give grace to those who hear." What I'm going to say is this. If that's true, generally speaking, that we need to make sure that what we say is edifying and uplifting, that it builds up other people, how much more important is that with our spouse? That we be careful what we say to our spouse, not hypercritical, not provoking, not always negative, not always argumentative. Again, we knew a couple who just were arguing and snipping at each other all the time, and we didn't think that was good when we first met them. I'm still not convinced that it's the best thing to do. Why is it that some people are very careful about what they say to their coworkers? And can be very critical of their spouse. Why is it that some people will be very careful what they say to their parents, but have no trouble at all unloading on their spouse? Why is it that some married couples will be very careful not to be critical of their children, want to build up their self-esteem, and have no problem at all constantly harping on and criticizing our spouse? We don't treat friends like that. Phileo. Friendship love. is such an important part of marriage. I think it is incredibly sad. If you are married and you're not married to your best friend, I feel sad for you. If you're married and you have some relationship with someone other than your spouse that you consider to be a better relationship than you have with your spouse, that makes me sad. Your marriage isn't what God intended for it to be. And so phileo love becomes an important part, an extremely important part of our relationship with God. And I think about Aquila and Priscilla. You know, Aquila and Priscilla, every time we see them, they're always mentioned together. And I love that. I love that. And I've thought for a long time, as a matter of fact, I remember thinking even before I was married, I want that. I want that. I want to be in a relationship where if somebody thinks about me, they just automatically think about her. If somebody thinks about her, they just automatically think about me. And I know lots and lots of couples like that. I won't embarrass anybody here. But there are lots of them sitting here. You just can't imagine. When you think about one of them, you think about the pair. You think about the couple. They are always together. They work in harness. They work hand in hand. They cooperate with one another. I think you even see that in 1 Peter chapter 3, where Paul says, or 1 Peter chapter 3, it wasn't Paul. I know that. In 1 Peter chapter 3, when Peter said, likewise, husbands, live with your wives in an understanding way, showing honor to the woman as the weaker vessel, since they are heirs with you of the grace of life, so that your prayers may not be hindered. One of the things that we always try to say, and especially to engaged couples, to couples who are about to get married. Sometimes somebody will say, I've heard men say this lots of times, I don't get women. I don't understand women. Let me tell you something, you're probably never going to. But thankfully, God does not require you guys, listen to this, God does not require you to understand women. But He commands you to understand one woman. And that's your wife. That's that phileo relationship. I know her. She knows me. She knows things about me that none of the rest of you know. And I'm grateful for a lot of that. That's phileo. That's an important part of the marriage relationship. And the fourth word is the word agape. This is the most common word that is translated love in the New Testament. It appears over 100 times. It will depend on which translation you use. The number is a little different if you're using the King James or the New King James, as opposed to the American or New American Standard or the English Standard Version, but over 100 times. And Thayer says that the word agape carries with it the idea of affection or goodwill or benevolence. The idea of agape is, I want what's best for the object of my love. And I will do anything to get it for them. I will sacrifice even my life to make sure that the one I love is taken care of, is provided for. Agape love. I want what's best for my spouse. I'm not primarily concerned. Let me back that up. I'm not primarily concerned about myself. Have you ever heard somebody say marriage is a 50-50 proposition? Let me tell you something. That's one of Satan's great lies. If you're trying to operate your marriage 50-50, you are in for a world of sorrow and pain. You know what the percentage really is in marriage? 0-100. And that's the only way it works. That's agape love. And here's what I mean by that. From the husband's perspective, he's not in the marriage for what is there for him. He is totally concerned about what she needs. 100%. It's 100% about her. And if she's a Christian, and if she has agape love, you know what she's thinking? It's not about me. It is about him. It is 100% about him. Now you think about that. 50-50. How are we going to split that up anyway? And I've known Christian couples who tried to do that with things like bank accounts and vacation and time and activities. Well, you got to do your thing, so next time we're going to do my thing. You got to buy a boat, I'm going to buy whatever. You know, she was buying the boat, by the way. That was her. But imagine how good a marriage could be if both spouses said, I don't care about me. It's not about me. It is totally about them. It's totally about my partner. I want them to be happy. I will sacrifice whatever it takes to make them happy. And so agape love suggests things like sacrifice. God so loved the world that look what he did. He loved his wife so much. Look what he did. Look what he sacrificed. Look what he gave up. She loved her husband so much. Look what she did. Look what she sacrificed. It has only been my privilege to know the Garrisons for the past few years, 10 years or so. Many of you knew them, have known them a lot longer than that. And it breaks my heart that Brother Garrison passed away today. But in the time that I have known the Garrisons, Gail, his wife, has been very sick, in very poor health. And what I've watched is I've watched him very tenderly and very lovingly take care of her and serve her and sacrifice a lot of his things, a lot of his desires, a lot of his likes, a lot of his hobbies. A lot of the things that he enjoyed doing, and I never heard him complain about it. As a matter of fact, when he talked about Gail, he always talked about her in such loving and compassionate language. I can't imagine how she's going to, in her physical state, how hard it's going to be for her to have lost him. That's agape. He sacrificed a lot, and that's just one example. That's just one example. Agape love is sacrificial love. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. Jesus was asked, what is the greatest commandment? But he said, this is the first and great commandment, but a second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. You don't have a closer neighbor than your spouse. You don't have a closer neighbor than your spouse. Agape love is sacrificial love. Agape love is selfish love. You know, Paul isn't talking about marriage in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. I don't usually ask for a show of hands, and you don't have to raise your hand if you're not comfortable doing that. But how many of you remember 1 Corinthians chapter 13 verses 4 through 7 being part of your marriage vows? Well, that's not very many. Or maybe people are just uncomfortable raising their hands. They were in ours. And again, Paul's not talking about marriage, but it is an incredible description of marriage. Love is patient and kind. Love does not envy or boast. It is not arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Agape love is totally about the object of love. In the kind of marriage that God wants us to have, it is not about you. And it never was, it never will be. If you're going into marriage thinking, now what's in this for me? You're going to have lots of problems. If you're in marriage and what you're thinking is, this is all about me, or I'm not getting what I think I should get out of this relationship, you're going to have lots of problems. If you will approach marriage with agape love, it's not about me at all. I will eat squash. I don't like it, but I will eat squash. I do draw the line at Brussels sprouts. I will go places. I will do things. Not because it suits me, but because it suits my spouse. Love, agape love, is selfless. And agape love is saving. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. Isn't it amazing that Paul compared the sacrifice of Christ? Christ loved the church so much, he loved people so much that he sacrificed his own life. Husbands, love your wives just exactly that way. And Paul tells Titus, the young preacher, to train the young women to love their husbands and children. Doesn't that sound a little bit odd in the 21st century in America? You have to teach women to love their husbands? You have to teach women to love their children? Well, it is agape love that is under consideration. He's not talking about eros. He's talking about making sure that we love them sacrificially, that they are first in our lives. Peter says something similar in 1 Peter chapter 3, "Likewise, wives, be subject to your own husbands, so that even if some do not obey the word, they may be won without a word by the conduct of their wives." A wife loving her husband sacrificially might be responsible, Peter says, for saving him, for leading him to the truth, for teaching him to the truth. Agape love, sacrificial love. And agape love is the super glue, the gorilla glue that binds everything else together. What happens to eros when one of the spouses becomes ill or one of the spouses becomes disabled? What happens to eros in a situation like that? Well, agape love steps to the forefront. I'm going to serve my spouse. I'm going to honor him. I'm going to honor her. I'm going to maintain my commitment to them because I want to serve them. I want what's best for them. If you're already married, is storge love a part of your relationship with your spouse? You understand and recognize and appreciate the significance of that family bond? Do you appreciate the fact that your closest living kin, your closest relative in the whole world is your spouse? What about eros? Do you understand and appreciate the importance of the sexual relationship in marriage? It's so important that Paul said, don't neglect it. And if it's neglected, it needs to be by consent. And if it's neglected, it needs to just be for a temporary period of time. You come back together sexually. Why? Because the sexual relationship, again, that is a special bond that you share with your spouse and no other living human being in your lifetime. Will you ever share that bond with anyone else? What about phileo love? Is your spouse your friend? If not, what can you do to change that? What can you do to make sure that your spouse is your friend? What can you do to make sure that they know that they are your best friend? And that no other human relationship, their parents, their co-workers, their buddies, their pals, their children, no other human relationship takes precedence over this relationship. You're not just my friend, you are my best friend. And agape love. Agape love. Are you in marriage thinking, what's in this for me? If you are, I don't know how to say that. It's tragic, I think. When people in marriage are thinking, what's in this for me? How can this help me? How can this benefit me? What can I get out of this? If that's how you and your spouse, or even just one of you in a relationship, are approaching marriage, you're going to have lots of problems. What an incredible joy to be in marriage and know and understand it's not about me at all. It is totally about my spouse. And let me tell you something, if your spouse has that exact same attitude about marriage, It is a relationship that transcends in terms of fulfillment, in terms of joy, in terms of happiness, in terms of peace, transcends anything else. Any other kind of relationship that we can have in this life. I know that Jesus said we don't marry in heaven. Responding to some criticism that he'd heard from the Sadducees. But I think sometimes we take that to mean That we won't have these kinds of relationships with other people in heaven. I don't believe that. God intended for the best human relationship that a person will ever have on this side of heaven to be marriage. So whatever takes its place in heaven is going to be infinitely better. Infinitely better. This relationship that we sustain with our spouse that can help us to understand and appreciate the relationship that Christ has to the church and can teach us the importance of love. Do you love your spouse? Guys, do you love your wife? Do you tell her? And do you mean all of this? Ladies, do you love your husbands? And do you tell them that you do? And I would encourage that, by the way. The old joke, which really isn't all that funny, I think, about the guy who told his wife he loved her when they got married, and then he never said it again, and when somebody asked him about it, he said, well, I told her once, and if I ever change my mind, I'll let her know. That violates at least three of those four. Love your spouse. Well, that's my lesson on the four loves and the four loves in marriage. And remember that Paul, by inspiration, the apostle of Jesus, used marriage to illustrate Christ and the church. Are you a part of the body of Christ? Are you a part of the church? Are you a part of the bride of Christ? If you're not, the invitation is for you. Nathan has chosen the song, He Hideth My Soul. You can stand up in front of this group of people and confess that you believe Jesus is God's Son, and let us know that you have repented of your sins and allow one of us to assist you in being baptized into Christ for the remission of sins. That's the marriage ceremony. You can become a part of the bride of Christ. Come back into a faithful relationship with God. Remember that in the Old Testament, when the Israelites were unfaithful, God called that adultery. They were dishonoring the marriage relationship between God and his people. He called on them. He sent them prophet after prophet and called on them to come back and repent and be faithful. If you've been unfaithful to your relationship with God, you can come back, and we would be honored and thrilled to help you do that if that's what your need is. If you're here and you're subject to the invitation and we can help you in any way, please come down to one of these front seats right now while we stand and sing. We invite you to come.